Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And today we're talking about, you guessed it, a board game.
Yay.
Yay. It's about time.
Yeah.
So we've got a sort of stick on our hands today. Not necessarily an older game, but one that's very high regarded. We're going to talk about how to play it, the strategies involved, and we're going to talk about the game's design. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Castles of Burgundy, designed by Stefan Feld and published in 2011 by Ravensburger. So almost 10 years old.
Almost 10 years old.
And it was 2011 Spiel des Jahres recommended. And it also was nominated for a bunch of awards like Golden Geek, Trick Track d'Or, like a bunch of the stuff we usually bring up.
Uh-huh. And it's also ranked number 14 on Board Game Geek's top-rated list.
Oh, wow.
Sandwiched between Spirit Island at 13 and Terra Mystica at 15.
Wow.
And Scythe is at 12. We've talked about a lot of these games on this podcast.
Yeah, it's a wonder we haven't talked about this one yet.
And Seven Wonders Duel at 16. Honestly, there's just this stretch, 12 to 16, that we have talked about almost every game, except for the one right in the middle. So here it is, Castles of Burgundy. For a short description of what the Castles of Burgundy is about, in the Castles of Burgundy, players attempt to earn the most points in 25 turns by expanding their kingdom and managing their resources efficiently while competing for resources against their opponents. Each turn, players roll two dice. On each player's turn, they spend their dice to take actions that acquire territory tiles, play those tiles in their kingdom, or gain resources. Each action will gain a player more resources or earn them points. After five rounds of five turns each, the player with the most points wins. It's a game with a limited number of turns. Every turn you roll two dice, and you spend those dice, one then the other, to take certain actions that could gain you resources or earn you points. At the end of the game, the player with the most points wins.
I want to clarify that these aren't like your typical resources, like wood and clay and stuff.
Sure.
There are really only two resources that are tracked, which are workers that allow you to modify the die roll by one or either up or down.
Mm-hmm.
And notably, you can go from 6 to 1 and 1 to 6 on this die.
Sure.
And
the other resource
is silverlings, which are used to buy special buildings and are worth points at the end of the game.
Right. And maybe the traditional definition of what a resource is in a game, those would be the only ones you might consider in this game. But I was just kind of using it as a blanket term also to refer to the territory tiles and also the goods, which can be sold with specific actions to acquire those silverlings.
Right.
So you roll two dice, and then you spend those dice to take actions that could gain you things or earn you points. So let's go a little bit into detail about what the game is about, how to play it, and then we'll get into strategy. So first of all, this is a game for 2 to 4 players. The board is set up with 6. What are they called?
I think they're called depots.
Depots, yes. There's 6 trade depots. Each trade depot can hold a number of tiles, and these are the territory tiles that you add to your kingdom. So there's 6 trade depots plus the market in the center, where you spend dice to acquire the tiles from the trade depots. You spend money to acquire the tiles in the center of the board. And then each player has their own kingdom board, which has a hexagonal kingdom divided into smaller hexes. And every player starts with a castle in the center hex, and then the hexes radiating around the castle have different colors to them, which match the different kinds of territory tiles that you can acquire and place in the kingdom. Each territory tile face in your kingdom has a die face on it, a different die face ranging from 1 to 6, and each of the depots has a die face 1 to 6. And that is a clue as to how you use your dice to acquire and place tiles. So there's a starting player. There is a starting player track, which players will move their pawns up. And well, actually, you don't move them down. You move your pawns along the tracker to change the starting player order. We'll tell you a little bit more about how to do that in a moment. What else am I missing? There's a number of piles of... I guess we could talk about the different kinds of territory tiles, maybe?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Or maybe we should talk about what you can do with your dice. I guess we should talk about what you can do with your dice, and then we'll talk about the different kinds of territory tiles. Okay, so... So on a player's turn, you roll two dice. If you're the starting player, you roll a third die, which just determines where a good goes into the depots. So I guess we should talk about that. There's six kinds of goods, which are square tiles that you acquire and keep in a specific part of your player board. Each good has a different die face associated with it. And the goods stacks are sort of how you keep track of the turns of the game. So at the start of the game, you shuffle the good tiles face down and deal them into five stacks of five. At the start of a round, which is sort of like a grouping of five turns, you take one of those stacks, flip it face up, and deal it into five turn spaces. And then at the start of every turn, you roll that third die if you're the starting player, and you take the topmost good tile that's been flipped over and revealed, and you add it to the depot that matches the die. And then there's an action that you take later in the game that will let you acquire these goods from the depots, put them in your personal supply, and then another action later in the game that lets you sell them. So that's the importance of the goods. But you place one into a depot every turn, and then when the good tiles have run out, that means that you're on the last turn of the game. Okay, so anyways, players roll their two dice, and then... when it's your turn, you get to spend both of your dice, one after the other. There's a couple little bonus actions that you can take in between spending your dice, and we'll get into that. But when it's your turn to spend your dice, you can do one of three things with the die. Three, maybe four. You can do one of four things with the die. The first thing you can do is you can spend a die to acquire a tile, a territory tile, from the depot matching the die's face. So if you spend a six, you can acquire a tile from the six depot. Spend a two, you can acquire a tile from the two depot, etc. The second thing you can do is you can spend a tile to place a territory tile into your kingdom into a hex space that matches the die face that you spent. So if there is a space next to your castle that has a two on it, you can spend a two to place a tile of the correct color into that slot. Now, there's a couple rules. Each of the different kinds of tiles has a color to it, and your board is sort of divided into these different kind of color groupings. So you can only put, for example, a brown building tile into a brown building tile space on your kingdom. Also, second caveat is you can only place a tile in your kingdom next to a tile that's already in your kingdom. So you start with the center space in your kingdom filled with a castle, and therefore you can only build into the six adjacent spaces next to that castle. But once you've built into those spaces, that then means more spaces are adjacent to your tiles, and you can continue to expand outwards. So that's the second thing you can do with your die, is you can spend it to place a tile in your kingdom. The third thing you can do is you can spend a die to sell all the goods of one particular color. Good of a particular color will also have a die face to it. So like, for example, I believe the blue goods have a one on them. So if you spend a one, then that means you can sell all of your blue goods that you have in your inventory. There's like a little spot for inventory in the top left of your player board, and you can only have up to three goods of any given color at a time.
It's three different types of colors, but you can have as many of that color as you want.
Right, I misspoke. You can have any amount of goods, but only of up to only three kinds of colors. So if I have a bunch of blue tiles stacked up, I can spend a one, sell all the blue tiles because they have a one on them, and I get one silverling per tile I sold that way. And when you sell tiles, you put them face down on your board in another slot that's been given to you.
Right.
Okay,
So silverlings give you sort of a bonus action that doesn't cost a die, but I believe you can only do it once per turn.
Sure. Silverlings, the last thing that you can do with a die is you can spend a die to get two workers.
Right.
And workers are just a resource that you can spend to modify any die by one.
Yeah.
Either plus one or minus one. And you can modify a one into a six by giving it minus one, or a six into a one by giving it plus one, technically. So it sort of loops back around when you're adding or subtracting from a die.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so those are the four things you can do with your dice. In addition to that, you can spend silverlings as a bonus action.
Right. So when you set up the market, in the middle there is what's called the black market. It's a number of hex tiles where you place tiles from, but the black market tiles are in sort of their own special stack. They can be tiles of any type, and they'll be denoted as black market tiles because they have a little black hexagon on the front. By spending two silverling, you get the option to take any of those tiles for yourself.
Yes.
And then again, you can
only do that once per turn.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, every player has a, they have storage spaces for their goods. They also have storage spaces for their tiles. A player can only have three tiles in their storage at a time. So if you were to acquire a fourth tile, then you have to eliminate one of your storage tiles from the game to make room for it. And tiles go into your storage before you play them onto your board.
Right.
So again, it takes a die to acquire the tile and put it in your storage, and then another die to play a tile from your storage to your kingdom. Okay, so let's talk about the different kinds of tiles.
Yeah.
So we've mentioned black market, which in itself isn't actually a type of tile or a color of tile, but any of the other colors of tiles can appear in the black market stack of tiles. Black market tiles just go into the center of the board. They never show up in the depots. But the depots, they have slots where you put the tiles that you can acquire from them. These are the six spaces in the center of the board, the sort of shop market board where you acquire tiles from. And the spaces have predetermined colors. So every round, you're going to have the same number of each color of tile in the same depots, if that makes sense. So, for example, in the one spot, if you're playing a two-player game, there's a spot for pastures, which are a light green color, and a spot for ships, which are blue. And every turn of the game, when you refill the board, you will always add a pasture, or sorry, every round of the game, when you refill the board, you will add a pasture tile and a ship tile to those slots. So it's sort of like you get the same thing every round. With some variance, because certain tiles have different effects. So let's just go through what they are. So I've mentioned pasture tiles. Pasture tiles can have one of four different kinds of animals on them, either chickens, sheep, pigs, or cows. And when you play a pasture tile into your kingdom, it scores you 1 point per animal on that tile. But when you play them into a pasture, sometimes the pasture can be connected to other pasture tiles in your kingdom. And if you have other animals that match the one you just played, you score those tiles again. So if you played a three chicken tile into a pasture that already had a four chicken tile in it, you get 7 points.
Yep.
The next kind I just mentioned is the boat, which is a blue tile. When you play a boat tile in your kingdom, you first move your turn order pawn one space forward. So this could potentially change the turn order and allow you to go first next turn. You also get to choose one depot from the six depots and acquire all of the goods from it, or at least as many goods as you can fit in your supply.
Right. If you can't fit any goods in your supply, they stay on the depot.
Yes. The next kind of tile, we'll talk about castle tiles. Mm-hmm. These are dark green in color. You start with one on your board, but it doesn't have any effect when you play it on your board. But every castle you play after on your board essentially allows you to take a free action as if you spent a die of any face. So if you place a castle in your kingdom, you can take any of the dice actions, like acquiring a tile from the depots, playing a tile into your kingdom, acquiring two workers, or selling goods. You can just do whatever you want. Doesn't matter what the die face is. It's like you get a wild card die for that action. And you take that action immediately when you play the castle into your kingdom. Let's see. The next type of tile we can talk about is the mine. This is a dark gray tile. When you play it in your kingdom, nothing happens, but at the beginning of every round, so after every five turns, there's the start of a new round when you uncover a new pile of goods and put them into the round spaces, you get a silverling for every mine in your kingdom. Let's see, there are the... I think that just leaves...
The complicated ones.
The complicated ones. So I guess... When we talk about the complicated ones, let's just be a little general here.
Yeah.
So the first kind of complicated tile, these are the tiles that have multiple effects depending on what you put in your kingdom. So the first one are the building tiles or the town tiles. These are brown. And each town tile has one of a number of different buildings depicted on them. And depending on what building is depicted on the tile, when you play it in your kingdom, you take a different action. But essentially, every town tile allows you to take a specific bonus action. And that action could be like acquiring a new tile from a depot. It could be mean putting a tile into your kingdom as if you had spent any die of any number. It could mean gaining workers or gaining silverlings. It could mean selling a good immediately or a pile of goods immediately.
There's one that gives you 4 points outright.
Yeah. So there's a number of different effects. It depends on what building you see on the front of that tile. Those tiles are brown again. And then the final kind of tile that you can add to your kingdom is the technology tiles. These are yellow, and technology tiles modify the rules of the game for the player that acquired it and played it in their kingdom, or in some cases they give you bonus points at the end of the game. So it's usually one or the other. Either they modify the rules. For example, there's a technology tile that says anytime you spend a die to gain workers, you also gain one silverling. So it's a slight modification of the rules, but just for the player that played that technology tile in their kingdom. And then another example is there's some technology tiles that'll give you 4 points per building of a specific kind in your game. So like it'll give you 4 points per tower in your game. Actually, I'm not sure if there is a 4 points per tower since towers give you 4 points.
Either way, there's four points for buildings of different types.
Exactly. There's like 4 points for each kind of animal in your pastures, etc. So either a yellow tile, a technology tile will give you points at the end of the game, depending on what else is in your kingdom. Or they'll modify the rules for you to make certain actions benefit you more than other players, or make certain things a little easier for you as a player.
Right.
Okay.
Did we mention the kind of bonus scoring?
No. Okay. So let's talk about how you score points in this game.
Right.
So let's see.
Where to start? On the board, the different sort of spaces you can place tiles are in different districts. Mm-hmm. These are just the collections of groups of the same color. So like on the baseboard, there's two blue districts because there's two separate groups of three blue spaces. Mm-hmm. And when you fill in a district, you get bonus points based on what round it is. So if you fill in a district in round one, you get 10. Round two will give you 8 points, then 6, 4, and 2.
Yeah. So the sooner you fill in a district completely, the more points you get in this game.
Right. Additionally, the first person to complete their spaces of a certain type, meaning fill in every space of a certain color, gets additional bonus points, and then the second person to do so also gets bonus points.
Yeah, and that depends on...
Yeah, I believe it's 5 points on how many, for the first player.
So it depends on how many players are playing.
Oh, right, right.
But it's either 5 to 7 points for the first player that fills them in, and then 2 to 4 points for the second player that fills them
right,
in.
Right, okay.
For example, there's, like you mentioned, there's two blue districts, each with three spaces in them. So when you fill in the first blue district, you get just however many points you get for filling in a district in whatever round you're in. So if you're in the first round, you get 10 points. And then when you fill in the second district, first of all, you just the same, you get the number of points you get for filling in a district, but then you also get that first player to fill in all of the blue spaces, if you are indeed the first player. And that's a little token that only one player can take. And then the second player gets a smaller token when they fill theirs in.
Yeah.
So for additional ways to score points, pasture pieces, so the light green tiles that have animals on them, when you play those in your kingdom, they score you points. The tower, which is one of the building tiles that you can put in your kingdom, also gives you 4 points.
Right. And then also each silverling is worth 1 point at the end of the game.
Yes.
And each good that you have unsold is worth 1 point.
Right. And every 2 workers you have at the end of the game are also worth 1 point.
Yes.
So there's many ways to score points. The most common way to score points is to fill in your districts. I think that's about it for rules of the game. Again, 5 rounds. Each round has 5 turns. And on a player's turn, you roll 2 dice and you spend them to do those actions like we said. And the goal of the game is to get the most points. So let's talk strategy. How do you get the most points?
Okay, so I think I want to start off by saying that you should try and fill in at least 1 or 2 districts in the first 2 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's when the points for filling in the districts are at the highest. And so you're making like 4 or 2 points more than every other player by doing so. Right. There are some that are really easy to fill in. Like there is a single pasture. This is, again, on the base board, not with any of the expansion boards.
Right. We should mention that every player has an identical board when you play with the base game.
Yeah. So on the base game, there is a pasture by itself in one spot, and that's a really easy one to fill in if you can get to it. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, you might be able to fill in one of the ship districts.
Well, there's a single building district right next to your castle.
That too.
So by playing a single building in the first turn, you get 10 points.
Right. That's probably the easiest one.
The concise way of putting it is just have a plan for filling out territories early game. Early game, filling out territories gives you a ton of points. And so you should always have a plan for how you're going to do that.
Right.
And having a plan for doing that could mean spending your dice on a turn where you can't do it just to get like workers so that you have the right numbers for a future turn when you can do it.
Right. I think to me, getting workers early game is pretty useful. Because that means that, like, you're not at the whim of the dice later on.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of take a slower start, but you can also see, like, what animals your opponents are taking for the pastures or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's also worth noting that you generally want to be the last person to play a ship. This is because of the way the turn order actually works. If when you play a ship, you move your pawn forward on the turn order track, and the person who's furthest ahead is the person who's the first player. But mm-hmm. if you're on the same space, the person who's on top is the first player, and when you move your pawn, you go on top of anybody who's in front of you. Which means that if you are already in the lead and you move forward, that's fine, but then the next time somebody plays a ship, they will be in the lead for first player. Yes. And this is pretty important at the end of rounds because castles are just generally pretty useful since they let you use any die, but they're also super contested because there's very few on the board, especially compared to every other type of building.
We like to mention on this game, we like to talk about tempo when we're talking about strategy of a game. And castles are the easiest and best way to gain tempo over your opponents in this game. They essentially let you take a free bonus turn of any die. So not only is it an extra turn, which is powerful, but it's also an extra turn that costs 0 resources. So you don't have to spend any workers or silverlings to do what you're trying to do.
Theoretically.
So castles are the most contested resource in this game. Also, castles are the second easiest type of tile to fill in completely on your board and get that first player to fill in all tiles of one color because there's only 4 other tile spaces on your board. The easiest is technically the mine, which there's only 3 mine spaces. But second easiest is castles. And castles are way better than mines.
I actually think mines are pretty good because So for one thing, having the Silverling every round means that you are more likely to be able to buy the black market shops, which just gives you a lot of options. You're not kind of weighed down by the dice rolls to buy buildings or buy tiles.
Mm-hmm.
And then additionally, I mean, Silverlings are worth points at the end of the game, so you're at least getting 1 point every round. But additionally, because they're easy to fill in and get the first to complete bonus, it's not a bad investment to get one early because you could pretty easily sneak in a first to complete.
Sure.
If you think about it, it just getting one at the start puts you closer to that goal than everybody else who doesn't have mm-hmm. one.
Also, getting one at the start technically earns you 5 points if you don't spend the Silverlings, because a Silverling is worth one. Or I guess it gets you 4 points, because the Silverling is worth 1 point at the end of the game. And if you build a mine in the first round, it'll generate 4 Silverlings by the end of the game.
Right. That's sort of a good baseline for a tile.
Not a bad investment. Yeah, 4 points for a tile is a good baseline. I mean, that's what you get for like the territory or for the towers, the tower building tiles, because they give you just 4 flat points. You're also hoping to get more than 4 points for every animal tile you place over the course of the game.
Yeah.
Okay, so good points. I like to say late game, you want to have a plan for finishing all territories of a particular type, because once you pass the third turn, then you get more points for filling in all territories of a given type than just filling in one district. Because a district will be worth 4 points and then 2 points. But in a two-player game, or at least in any number of players, will give you more than 4 points for filling in all territories of a particular type.
The completion bonus.
The completion bonus, yes. Yeah. At least if you're the first player. So I think early game, have a plan for just filling out districts. Late game, have a plan for filling out all districts of a particular color.
Right.
And I think it's important to just always be like having a plan for getting the castle, or at least getting maybe a priority building. Oh, there is a specific thing that we didn't mention about buildings, and that's for your building districts, you can't have 2 buildings of the same type in them. So right. That's important to keep in mind when you're acquiring buildings.
Right. I think most buildings are pretty good, but yeah, you don't want to buy more buildings than you can place.
In terms of tempo, a building is almost identical to a castle, except it's more restricted in what you can do with it. But
right.
a building will usually do the same thing that a castle would do. Just it restricts what you can do specifically. So like there's a building that lets you acquire a tile from a depot, but that tile has to be either a mine, a tech card, or a pasture, or not a pasture, a mine, a tech card, or a castle. And there's another one that says you can acquire a pasture or a boat from a depot. And then there's another one that gives you workers. So it's kind of like each building is doing what you would do with a castle. So if the castle is already taken, then it's not a bad thing to take the buildings. But the big difference between buildings and castles is that now there's more building districts, so there's more chances to score the district completion points. But buildings are the hardest type of tile to fill in completely because they have the most spaces.
Right.
They have like 9 or 10 spaces on your kingdom. It might be more than 10 or 11.
It's like 11? 12, I think.
So there's like a 5, 2 threes, that's 11, 12. Yeah, it's 12. There's 3 in the top right, 3 in the bottom left.
Oh, okay, yeah.
There's the 1 in the top left, and there's the 5 in the bottom right. So, yeah, there's 12 building spaces compared to the 4 castle spaces.
Right. However, there are just way more buildings on the board than pretty much any other type of tile.
Yeah.
So they're much more abundant, and I want to say they're more abundant in the black market stack.
Mm-hmm. We certainly came across a lot of them in our last playthrough.
Yeah, so to me, I think it's easier to plan around like getting buildings to take bonus actions than it is to get the castle. Mm-hmm. Like the castle's a premium resource, but as far as like your main strategy, I think you should be looking at the buildings at what you can get.
Now it's important to remember that you only earn points from filling out districts, filling out all districts of a particular color, and playing either specific tech pieces, playing pasture pieces, or playing towers, which is a specific building type. So when you're taking these bonus actions, you want to make sure that these bonus actions are leading towards one of those point gaining scenarios. So if you're taking a bonus action to when you play your castle, you want to make sure that bonus action is either going to fill out a district, or it's going to start filling out a district that eventually you plan on filling all types of, or it's just gaining you points, like you're playing a pasture tile. Right. Or in some cases, it might be important, just like at the end of a round, to use your bonus action to play a boat so that you can take the first turn next round and guarantee you'll get another castle or some other priority tile.
Right. Something I do want to bring up is that goods are pretty useful. It's hard to get more than 4 points off of a boat by getting goods, unless there's like two of one type and two of another type on that depot.
Yeah.
But like, it's generally a good idea to try and at least get maybe 3 points from each or 3 goods from each boat you play. Because like, I mean, they're silverlings. You can convert them to silverlings, but since unsold goods are worth points, it's not a bad idea to just stack up a bunch of goods. Because, like, it's worth noting that boats do give you points. They don't directly give you points, but they very easily can convert to points.
Sure. It's sort of, it's a couple steps removed from being points, I guess. But, I mean, not necessarily. You do get the goods.
It's a little less liquid.
But, yeah.
It's like a bond versus cash.
I guess it's also worth mentioning that that silverlings also can be converted into bonus turns, because extra turns are good in this game. Silverlings are kind of like an extra tile acquisition turn.
Yeah.
And they can give you tiles that other players don't have access to. They can even give you a castle. There is a castle in the black market that you could find.
Right.
So we're talking a lot about like actions you should want to take, but you're ultimately limited by what die you roll or what die faces you roll. So I think one thing that's important to mention here is that you should prioritize your actions, like what you need to do with your dice, sort of like a worker placement game, but also a worker placement game where you have to like spend something in order to place a worker. Like a random element. I mean, that's kind of
it's mildly a like press your luck game in that you kind of want to think about how likely you are to make the die roll you need. And if you're unlikely to do so, then you should probably try and, you know, prepare for it.
I think what I'm kind of trying to get at is that, like, you know, when you roll your dice, there's a lot of things you can do with them, and you want to prioritize them based on like what you think your opponents are going to do, what resources you think are contested. Like, for example, you could spend one die to acquire a tile and the other die to place it in your kingdom. But if there's a second tile that you're really keen on getting, but you think your opponents might want it that you can get with that second die, then it might be better to just acquire two tiles for the turn rather than acquire a tile and place it that turn. Similarly, you can acquire workers every turn by spending dice, and you could even like spend your first die on acquiring two workers, then use those two workers on the second die to get a specific resource. So there might be one resource that you're interested in getting, and you could do that, but maybe there's two other resources that you're kind of interested in getting, and you could spend your two dice to get those two resources rather than spending the one die for the workers and the other to get the one. So, you know, it's just, you need to just make sure like you're getting the resources that you need before your opponents can take them from you by spending your dice wisely. And if there's nothing for you to do, getting workers is a good thing because it means that in a future turn, you'll have the ability to get whatever priority resource you need. As long as you have 3 workers, any die can be any other die.
Right.
Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. So I do want to mention that you should probably try and get a tech tile early that helps you with your dice management, either one that makes you get more workers or gets worker making better, or one that like outright lets you modify dice. Like, yeah, there's one that says whenever you play a pasture or ship tile, you can modify your die roll by plus or minus one to do so.
Yeah, it's kind of like there are a number of tech tiles that sort of give you free workers for different actions in the game. And yeah, getting those early will save you resources in the long run and let you take more priority actions when you need to.
Right. It makes your turns where you have to get workers more efficient. And then, it makes your turns where you need to spend them more efficient. And so you want to get those early because it adds up towards the end of the game.
So I acquired, like, two of those the last time we played, but I think it's also important to note that, like, when you get one of those, you should really revolve your strategy around them. Like, yeah. I got the one that modified my dice for placing pastures and boats in my kingdom, and I did not finish either pastures or boats by the end of the game. I didn't, like, I wasn't the first player to put all my pastures in. I wasn't even the second player. I didn't finish all of my pastures and boat spaces, and that essentially meant that I wasted a turn early game. I didn't, like, take full advantage of the dice manipulation that I had acquired. So you could also sort of think of, like, all the times that I acquired workers, spent a die that acquired workers that game, which was a number of times. I was kind of wasting those turns too, because I could have just been using the free workers I got from that tech tile. So think of these tech tiles that modify your dice or sort of give you free workers as a direction for where you should take your strategy later in the game.
Right. Yeah.
Make the most of your tech tiles. That's a succinct way of putting it.
Yeah, I think the tech tiles that give you points for buildings aren't as good in the early game. Because, it's hard to guarantee you'll get all four of those buildings, or to max it out.
Sure. There is a tech tile that lets you have duplicate buildings, so maybe if you get that plus a tech tile that gives you points per building, that could end up being a good strategy, but that's probably the only case in which you'd want to focus on one kind of building.
And then on the other hand, I think tech tiles that are worth getting early for points are the one that makes that one that lets you get points for every different type of animal you have, because that just kind of changes the way you treat animals and makes it a little different, especially if you're, like, at the start of the game, you're competing over the same type of animal with another player. And then also the one that gives you points for every different type of good you've sold is another good one to get early. Because it gives you sort of a direction to take as well, one that benefits you for selling goods to get silverlings to spend.
The tech tile that specifically gives you 4 points for each type of animal in your pastures, you can also kind of think of that as, like, at the end of the game, you take 4 free turns placing an extra animal, like, tile in each of your pastures with 4 of that animal on it. Right. If you think about it that way, that's worth a ton of points and tempo. Yeah. Not necessarily tempo, because it happens at the end of the game, but it's still worth a ton of points. So, yes, certain tech tiles that give you points, especially ones that are easier to reach the ceilings of, are worth building around. But the ones that are difficult to reach the ceilings of, like the buildings one, not worth building around. And the ones that give you free resources, definitely take advantage of those, especially early in the game, because the more turns you have to take advantage of them, the more value you get out. And value is points.
Yes.
Okay. And I think the last thing that I would like to say for strategy is just, like, when in doubt, just grab some animals, because they'll be worth points. There's, like, sometimes you'll be thinking to yourself, like, what can I do? I guess the other thing you could do is get workers if there are no animals, or sometimes grabbing workers is the way to go if you don't have any. But when in doubt, getting animals guarantees you points.
Yeah.
Okay. So before we talk about the design of the game, shall we get into our mid-roll promo section?
Right. I do want to say sorry if there's a little extra noise this episode. Jeff is dog sitting.
There's some rowdy dogs right behind me. And we're doing our best to record and edit their sounds out, but you'll just have to enjoy the sounds of dog combat.
All right.
We'll do a board game on dog combat.
Yeah. So, Okay, so you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter.
You can hit us up with suggestions for topics and games you'd like us to cover there. Again, that's Facebook and Twitter, BG Bros Cast. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have all of our episodes categorized and cataloged and tagged with the games we talk about in them. So if you're looking for our discussion on a particular board game, like I mentioned, we've covered Board Game Geeks rank number 12, 13, 15, and 16, Scythe, Spirit Island, Terra Mystica, Seven Wonders Duel, and many others that are listed highly. We haven't done any of the games above that yet. Terraforming Mars, sorry, we did that one. It's number nice. Four,
there we go.
If you want to hear our thoughts on those games or any other game, you can go to our website and search through the tags to find the game that you want to hear our thoughts on, and then I'll take you straight to the episode. If you don't see it there, hit us up with that suggestion again. Also on our website, you can find a link to our TeePublic store, teepublic.com/user/BGBcast, where you can get merch with our cool logo on it. That does it for BG Bros plugs. Let's hear from Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/TWAK. I stream on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and sometimes Thursday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to like 4 p.m. Central Time. I stream a lot of platform fighters, roguelites, different like strategy and competitive games, some single player games every now and then. I've been playing a couple different games really recently. And then I also stream Fortune Street on Fridays, which is quite an adventure. So you can follow me on that. You can go to a Discord server through there where you can talk to us and other fans of our work. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, and you can also go to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/IEatAtSonic. IEatAtSonic. It's an old username. I can't change it now. Where you can find videos made by me analyzing different games, such as The Witness and A Monster's Expedition. And then also, big announcement. I am launching another podcast with a friend of mine who was on an episode of Board Game Bros a long time ago. It is NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web, an analysis podcast of various media in, around, and on the internet. Our first episode is live now. You can find us at NetSurfer Pro on Facebook and Twitter. That's NetSurferPro. There we go. I messed it up. You can get updates on our next episodes through those, as well as, you know, talk to us, see what we're up to. And we'll be on other podcasting platforms soon. Also, it has some explicit language, unlike this podcast.
All right, so check out, be on the lookout for NetSurfer Pro. Follow them on socials and all that. For my plugs, you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs, and you can also find my Twitch stream at twitch.tv/RadicalHawks, twitch.tv/RadicalHAWKZ. I stream infrequently, but when I do stream, I play things like Dark Souls and Pokemon, and sometimes Teamfight Tactics and League of Legends. All right, so now let's get into the design of Castles of Burgundy.
Yes.
So this game is kind of like textbook elegant use of materials when it comes to the dice in this game. I feel like a lot of games might have drawn inspiration from this game, namely something like Coimbra. There we go, not Columbia. Yeah. Coimbra, in that like a die means a number of different things. But in addition to meaning a number of different things, each die itself is like an action in your turn. So the dice are action economies, and the face of the die describes what kinds of actions you can take with it.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of like, I feel like I've seen this a lot even before Burgundy. Just like, yeah, the fact that the die face is an action you take, and so what you roll determines what actions are available to you. But mm-hmm. I think what's more interesting to me is sort of how each tile both adds like abilities to you, but also is like your main way of scoring and acts as like a spatial management aspect. It's a pretty clean tile placement game in that regard, because you know, most of the resources you get that are like actual resources you spend are, you know, they kind of play back into the game pretty smoothly, but also just like, you know, these tiles give you bonus actions, these tiles give you resources, but there's no like extra rules on them, except for, I guess, the tech tiles and the like, there's no text on them. But then like the buildings turn what is a pretty basic action structure into something more deep and varied. So like it combines the actions you're allowed to take and like the upgrades for actions you take into the scoring method, which, I mean, I guess sort of that's common with point salad games, but I think in this game it's done specifically well.
I enjoy that because every action you take now, the actions feel like they're pretty limited just to your two dice. But the elements of the game, like the bonus actions that the tiles allow you to take, in addition to the workers and the coins, the silverlings, and how you spend those in this game, they all sort of combine and weave together to lead to some pretty creative turns that players can pull off. I think that's something that I haven't seen. I guess it pops up every now and then, but I feel like this game is one of the games where it does this with the fewest number of components. It makes these wizard plays, like these big brain plays, these combos that you can do in this game.
Yeah, it reminds me of plays in like trading card games. Just like you find a very specific interaction between the dice you have. In like the resources you have that lets you pull off something really cool.
I guess one way that this game does that is kind of something that interests me about this game, is that a player takes all of their turns before it passes to another player. It feels like usually in Euro games like this, each player takes like one action and then passes, and then that goes around until everyone's used all their actions. So it was kind of surprising, like when I was reading the rules, like, oh, I, when it's my turn, I get to do everything I want and then pass. And then it's the next person's turn. So I guess that's one element of like the rules structure, that some games, do away with. They'd rather like give players more opportunity to compete over resources. But in this game, because they just let people go, all at once, they can sort of construct these combo turns. But that's a combination of like how the rules or how the game is structured and the components of the game just working very neatly together in interesting ways.
Right. To me, I think it's also an element of like restrictions breeding creativity on the player side, though, because when you only have two specific numbers available, that conflicts with your goals oftentimes. And so it becomes a game of like, how do I manage these dice so that they still progress my goal, even though I have a role that doesn't directly do it. Like oftentimes the exact like dream scenario requires two very specific numbers, and everything outside of that you have to work around. But the way it does that is by like playing other tiles or spending dice in other ways.
Yeah, I think you bring up a very good point, because in a lot of games, this kind of randomness, where the dice sort of seal your fate, is a little frustrating, and that leads to like a less sort of like big brain intellectual type of game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The randomness, like the game's more about the randomness than it is about the strategy. But this game, a lot of the elements in this game sort of serve as like workarounds or brute force ways of dealing with what you've rolled. Even despite the massive amount of randomness or the massive influence that randomness has on what you do in this game, it gives you so many opportunities to work around that. And it makes the game less about hoping you roll the right numbers and more about like finding the path you must take through your turn to achieve what you want regardless of what you've rolled.
Right. Well, if we're going to talk about randomness, I want to really talk about randomness.
Okay.
So I believe this this term was coined by Jeff Engelstein, the term of input and output randomness as like two different ways that players interact with randomness. So input randomness happens before the player makes a decision and output randomness happens afterwards. Think of it like input randomness in this game is rolling your dice before you take your actions. And output randomness would be in like Dungeons and Dragons rolling for an attack. In that game, you've already decided to attack. You just are committed to rolling afterwards. In this game, it uses input randomness, which is generally it's what players generally respond to better for like strategy games. You'll see this a lot in strategy games, like having trade rows or, just in this case, rolling before you take your actions are variants of input randomness that you can kind of react to and plan ahead for. For me, I'm kind of mixed on this game. It feels a lot of times that the options of your dice are limited, especially like late into a round, like the fourth or fifth turn. Because like most of the tiles have been bought and you only have a few options for what to buy and a few options for what you can play. Also, you don't have every number available to you from your first space, which is a decision that baffles me.
Oh,
I don't know if you noticed, but there's two threes adjacent to your castle at the start and no sixes. Which I feel like that would have been a slam dunk. Like, oh, it's a hex grid. Place one of each die face. That way there's always a tile you can play turn one. But that's not how it is. And I guess, I mean, I don't know how to feel about it. You can always just spend the six to buy a tile. So it's not awful. But it's that might be a small thing. In general, it tries to vary the amounts of die faces in each district. Like the pasture in the top left has, I think, a 1, 2, 3, 5, and 6.
1, 2, 4, 5, 6.
Right. So it tries to give you a lot of options while still kind of limiting it, I guess. I think one thing that gets me is like workers are useful, but it highlights the lucky turns a bit more, I think. Because like the first time I played this, I was kind of not having a great time. Because I had to spend like 5 turns getting workers in the first 3 rounds, which is just one action. And in the end, I still did all right.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it felt like, oh, my opponent is rolling and taking their actions while I have to get workers. Now, it could be that I played wrong, and I will admit that. But I think to me, it just feels like the worker turn is painful more often than not. Actually, I think a better way to put it is when you take it ahead of time, it feels good because it feels like you're doing a smart move. But when you do it because you're desperate, that's when it feels bad. And I feel like this game doesn't have a lot of ways to help people that are desperate. Again, it could be a strategy thing. I'm not saying this is like something you should never do, but it is interesting to me, I guess.
Sure.
Like there's games where it does not help people who are desperate at all, like Agricola, but that kind of adds to the tone of the game. And I guess for this game, it is just a die-based game. Yeah. But I think the one thing is that the buildings are very smart in their implementation.
Sure.
Because like we said during like the strategy portion, buildings pretty much are just other actions. And so, worst case scenario, you can buy a building to take an action.
By the way, there's on the sixth space, which you cannot spend to build on turn one, there's a pasture and a building. And then with more players, there's also a boat and a castle.
So it gives you a building, which is pretty good. And then a boat if you're with 6 or more players. And that's also one that you have readily available.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a castle as well, which is just one of the best tiles in the game.
Yeah. But so, buildings are a kind of a good solution to the randomness of dice by saying that you might not be able to take the exact action you want, but you can work towards taking that action.
Mm-hmm. Also, there's more building spaces than any other space on your board, which exactly. means, there's more opportunities for you to do something with your buildings.
Right. There are, I believe there's two building spaces adjacent to your castle.
Yeah.
And because one of them is solo, it encourages you to get an early building, which I think mm-hmm. helps you realize that, oh, wait, I can use buildings to circumvent the dice.
Right. And the other one that isn't solo is connected to the largest territory, the largest district of buildings. So
right.
Right off the bat, you have essentially six building spaces to work with that you don't have to build any other kind of tile to access.
Yeah. And again, since buildings are the most abundant in the game as far as what you can get, it does encourage you to use them as actions or bonus actions. I think it's just it's likely that you'll end up making combos that way. Because yeah. you're more likely to get buildings that do stuff.
Right. And that one building, by the way, unlocks the castle spaces too. So it's sort of like from the beginning, you have extremely easy and direct access into the like good priority actions or the tiles that you want to place to take like bonus actions and do more in this game, regardless of what dice you roll. So I want to talk about that the turn order exchange mechanic in this game is pretty well integrated and interesting. Because I think a lot of things in this game, you can compare it to like worker placement games or other Euro games, where if there is a turn order change mechanic, it's usually like just its kind of own thing. And it's obviously changing the turn order is good when you're directly competing over resources. Because if you go first, then you get access to all the resources for your choice. But just that in this game, it's like also in addition to changing the turn order, first of all, there's the risk that somebody else could just pop right on top of you after you've gained the lead and switch the turn order once more. But it also gives you access to the goods, which you then sell for silverlings, or you can hold on to for points. And there's, I think the ships are the second or the third most easiest type of tile to fill in, I guess, tied with pastures and tech. But you have access to both shipping districts at the start of the game.
I was going to say, six in two players, boats are on, I believe, 1 in 4 depots, which means that you can get it with one worker no matter what. Which is also important to note. If you do the math.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like mechanics that use the way that they're displayed on the board as a mechanic. So in this way, the way that the components are placed on the board on top of each other is itself part of the mechanic. Mm-hmm. You know, you see it a lot with like point tracking. You just stack the pieces on top of each other. But this is like, what if that was the point?
I do also like a minor thing the tracker that you move your pawn along to determine turn order is like a horizontal tracker that goes left to right. And the two shipping districts in your kingdom horizontally extend from your castle left and right. So it's kind of interesting that like the two elements of the game visually kind of... match each other. There's like a visual connection there.
Speaking of like the flavor of the ship, yum. The two ship districts connect every other district except the castles. Mm-hmm. So they kind of act as a form of travel between your board by placing them.
Right.
Because like with at least two in any direction, you can get to every other district except the castle.
That's actually, there's a small tech district that's not connected to
really?
The ship at the bottom of your board.
I didn't know that.
But every other district is connected to the ships.
I thought the small tech district was part of the big tech district.
It's there's a three tech district that goes in a line up and to the right from your castle, and then a smaller three tech district that's kind of wedged.
Right. Okay. So
mines and cities.
Okay, so almost every district is connected through the ships, which is still thematic.
Yeah, there's a lot of thematic things in this game in terms of how it's placed. Like the mines are in a row, kind of like a mountain range. There's
the
big
pastures
next to the smallest town, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it's a farming town. And then there's a small pasture next to the biggest town, which is overcrowding.
Can you think of anything else to talk about this game strategy-wise?
Not particularly. I think it's just interesting that the Silverlings are both points and an important resource. This is still pretty common. But since Silverlings are 1-to-1 instead of like a more common 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio, it feels a lot more tricky of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, like a lot of games will give you points for leftover resources or money, but it's in a smaller ratio. Whereas this is just direct points.
The last thing that I could point out about this game is that it's only $40. And I feel like this is a pretty good bang for your buck game compared to, I think, like, because you think of like the average price of a board game these days is somewhere around $50 to $60. So for $40, there's a whole lot of game here. I think it's pretty replayable just because like the randomness sort of forces you in different directions. The different tech tiles that you might draw in the early rounds of the game can determine where you go. It feels like a very different game, I'm sure, with like two or more players. We've only really played it two players, but it feels pretty competitive. And I'm sure if there were more players, like the strategies would be a little more open because there's more tiles added to the game to acquire. You'd have to wait longer. So maybe you'd be forced to be a little more creative when it comes to your turn if you're later in the turn order. Maybe boats would be way more important in a multiplayer game. At $40, I'd say this is a pretty good price for a board game. I think you get a lot out of it.
Also, I should mention we did play this digitally, so we did not feel the tactiles.
Yeah. Yes. looking at pictures, they look decent enough to me. I'm looking at other games, by the way, in the $40 range, and they're pretty much all like two-player games. So, for a four-player game with a lot of interesting strategy and play paths that you can take, I'd say it's worth it. Anything else to say before the end of the episode?
Nope.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to our episode on the Castles of Burgundy.
See ya.
I was waiting for you to say thank you for listening as well.
Yeah. Well, Matthew, thank you for listening. Oh, I'm thankful very much.
Okay. Thank you for listening from both of us. We'll see you next time for another episode on board games.
See ya.